Welcome to Book Bumble, the podcast for people who love to read. In each episode, we'll introduce a stack of books that are tied together with a common connection to help take a deeper dive into each story.
We provide a space to talk books that is friendly and deep with a little hint of geek.
I'm Laura Pleasance.
And I'm Leslie Hopping.
And we are two friends who love spending time with our families, visiting libraries, and reading great books.
We are so happy you joined us. Let's get started.
Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Laura. Welcome, everyone. This is episode 17. Today, our stack of books is tied together with a theme of going back down the rabbit hole because we had to stop and research and wonder through each of these books. These are books that take you down the rabbit hole again and again.
And it's an appropriate theme for Valentine's Day because we love going down a good rabbit hole.
We do.
So Leslie, what book is going to get us started?
Well, I want to start with Clara and Mr. Tiffany by Susan Vreeland. This book actually came out in 2010 and has a very intriguing cover. At least I thought so. She also wrote The Girl in Hyacinth Blue, but this book seems to be her most recent book. Here's the starting point book. I'm sorry, the starting point for Clara and Mr. Tiffany. This book takes place in New York City near the end of the 1800s. Clara Driscoll is an artist. The story starts as she re-enters her work with Mr. Lewis Comfort Tiffany and begins her tenure of heading the women's glass cutting department for Tiffany Glass. He sees her for the treasure she is. She works with her girls and organizes them in ways that they can complete work that even the men can't finish in time. She comes up with new innovative ideas to use the stained glass and things like lampshades, which later became a trademark of Tiffany Glass. And she seems to inspire Mr. Tiffany at the times he needs her most. He's a little bit of a mess.
Okay.
So she kind of is there with him through a lot. But there are two problems. First is one of his policies. No women can work for him once they're married. So as soon as Clara feels she has the girl settled and working, one seems to fall in love and move on to another life. The second problem is that Mr. Tiffany won't recognize Clara and the other women for their work and effort in some of his most famous glassworks. Clara eventually has to choose between working with her hands and being proud of what she's putting out into the world, which is very important to her, or giving herself into love and starting a new chapter of her life. When she chooses the artist side, it puts her life on pause.
Okay. And the time period, that kind of goes along with thinking about, you know, women weren't allowed to be teachers once they married during that time period.
Yes. So, I mean, it seemed crazy when I read it, but the time period lends itself to that.
Yeah.
And when you had women who were finally being recognized in an area that they were proud of.
Yes.
It was hard sometimes for them to turn that off.
Well, yeah.
Of course. Whereas other women were perfectly fine with that. This historical fiction novel was intoxicating. Many of the women who are mentioned working for Clara, who did work for Mr. Lewis Comfort Tiffany, they are real. I mean, they're real people that worked with her. Also, it involves things going on in New York City at the time, including the strengthening of unions and the pushback of some of those unions when women were, quote unquote, taking jobs they felt were owed to them. Clara was a force of nature who continued to be challenged in her life and really relied on loyalty and being independent. Those were really important to her. Knowing that so much of it was real and taken from research was fascinating because Clara could have easily just slipped through history as a worker rather than a creator, and I really enjoyed that Susan Vreeland told her story. The relationships between characters were really well done, giving multi-layered life to the people in Clara's life. For quite a while, she lived in this boarding house and became family with the most amazing host of characters that lived here. The young women she hired were also huge parts of Clara's story, both inspiring and heartbreaking. It felt very true for the time. This book being a little over 400 pages gave me a lot of time to go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
The New York Times put together a great article about her for their, about Clara Driscoll.
Okay.
For their often overlooked series, and went into the fact that she and her sisters and mother wrote many letters, and about 350 letters survived and were used to build some background on Clara.
That is super interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Yes.
Some letters were found in New York City. Others were found in the Kent State University Library.
What?
Because she was originally from Ohio.
Okay. Wow.
I know. These letters and other information from Mr. Tiffany himself show that she came up with them, with most of the designs of the lamps.
Oh, wow.
Like she described, Susan Vreeland describes them in the book. But when you look online, like those are ones that she actually described in her letters to her family that she was thinking about showing Mr. Tiffany.
So she never received recognition or monetary reward for her work.
No, she he did. He was always in this competition with his father. He wanted to prove himself to his father. So it was this, the whole book is this crazy relationship between Mr. Tiffany and Clara Driscoll. And it's never like a romantic piece. It never goes there, but just this push and pull between the two of them, which is just very fascinating.
Yeah.
And sad and hope. I mean, it's all of the things. As I read, I would look up stained glass windows and cathedrals that she and the other women worked on, and the exact lamps she would mention, and get to see the actual pictures online,
cool.
Which was really neat. Like, they would specifically talk about parts they were trying to glass, they were trying to match, and then I would be able to look at those actual parts within the cathedral windows.
Wow.
Which was just really neat.
So neat.
I also really loved hearing about the intricate process, like I just started to say, about the creating of the stained glass. It was amazing, and this group of women worked together to share art and beauty with the world, which I remember you were talking about the glass chateau,
mm-hmm.
and getting to learn about some of that creation.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
It is.
Isn't it, how it's done.
Not as easy as I thought it was by any means.
Right. Even kind of dangerous, because didn't they use lead in between the panes of glass?
With their fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Just put the lead in.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah.
And because I was so intrigued, I now have The Tiffany Girls by Shelley Noble that I just picked up from the library. It includes Clara Driscoll, but focuses more on one of the other girls that you also read about in there.
Oh, I'm so excited for you to read that.
I'm really excited. And especially on the heels of this one.
Yeah.
So that was Clara and Mr. Tiffany by Susan Vreeland.
So it has great secondary characters, which I really love. But it came out in 2010. How did you find it?
I literally was just looking at, I love that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking at books from that time period, and I found that book, and it just looked so interesting.
Wow.
And the front is beautiful.
That sounds fantastic.
And after reading it, the fact that it's titled Clara and Mr. Tiffany.
Yes.
I think is really interesting, because that, I don't know, I'm going to let you discover why, but I feel like that really said it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, that sounds great.
Yeah. So what do you want to share next?
Okay, well, I've got one that was published in 2021.
Oh, it's much more recent.
Much more recent. It's called The Second Life of Muriel West by Amanda Schenendor, and it's historical fiction set in the 1920s, and it's the story of Muriel, who's married to a silent film star, and she's living this life of luxury and glamour in LA, but she feels empty and drifting. She does a lot of drinking and just thinking. So she notices this patch of skin on her hand, and she has it checked out by a doctor. It's kind of like a pale patch.
Okay.
And she discovers that she has leprosy.
Oh, gosh.
And she's immediately, and I'm talking immediately, taken from her home, her children, her life,
gosh.
And she's forced to live in a place called Carville Leprosarium.
Oh.
Which is like a home and a hospital for lepers. Obviously, Muriel's life completely changes. And it's actually kind of humorous in the book. She brings all of these, like, gowns and silk nightgowns and high heels and purses and jewelry, where she's not really going to need that there. And so to get out of there, patients had to test negative for the disease once a month for 12 months in a row.
Wow.
So it became, you know, something that people were, quote unquote, striving for when really they didn't have any control over it at all. So she's absolutely desperate for this result because she wants to go home. And she really struggles at Carville with fitting in with the other patients and also finding a purpose.
Right.
Because you can't just sit around all day, which she kind of does at first. But, you know, she can't do what she used to do, which was a lot of drinking.
Right. She can't self-medicate.
Right.
To make the day go faster.
Right. She also struggles. There are some very harsh medical treatments, some of which are experimental.
Oh,
and
geez.
They're trying to find a cure, and she volunteers.
Yeah. Because she's desperate.
She is.
Yeah.
And then also one of the hardest things is just the stigma and the embarrassment of the diagnosis. You know, you don't want anybody to know that that's what you have.
A leper.
You're a leper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that was a pretty, that's a pretty terrible term. But that was, you know, very common. So the other thing is she's really, really heartbroken to be away from her children.
Oh, yeah.
And she sometimes calls home and can talk to them, but they're little.
Right.
They don't understand where
and you're
she
gone
is.
For at least a year.
Yeah.
I mean, at least.
At the minimum.
Right. Oh.
And very few people are leaving.
Yeah.
The book is also about her finding community in the hospital because she has to reinvent herself. And she has to face some really pretty difficult truths, both about herself and about the future. And she also learns to work and use her gifts and talents to be useful. Mm-hmm. And there's some good secondary characters who, you know, you can imagine a lot of the work is medical. And she finds that she's actually really good at some things that she I don't think she ever would have learned about herself when she lived in LA. But some of the women who run the hospital, they're nuns, and some of them are kind and some are very harsh and very strict for reasons. And there are just some interesting things that happen to other patients that are in the hospital, some situations where they really have to help people that are dealing with things other than leprosy.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just like a well-layered book. And she, it's interesting to find, to watch her find herself in this way and to realize that she can be useful.
Yeah.
So,
which is what she was looking for kind of before.
She was, but she didn't really know it.
Yeah.
Also, the setting is fantastic, and I really love the 1920s time period. They talked a lot about different details that were great. Also, I thought the hospital and the grounds were really described well, and it's all taking place in Louisiana, so there's a lot of neat things about the surrounding area and about the weather. It was just really good. And talk about a book that sent me down the rabbit hole. So I went all in learning about the topic of leprosy and the Carville Leprosy Hospital, which was a real place. So first of all, I learned that leprosy is actually Hansen's disease. It is not the same type of leprosy that's described in the Bible.
Okay. That's good to know because I had no idea.
I didn't either. And Hansen's disease is curable with treatment.
Okay.
But at the time, they didn't know what the treatment was.
Right.
So that's why they were trying all these crazy things mm-hmm. in this hospital. And just using people as...
Yeah.
But, I mean, they were volunteering.
Right.
It wasn't against their will. So once patients have been on the drug therapy that we have now for 72 hours, they're no longer contagious.
Oh.
And actually, like in the book, people were just like totally freaked out if you had mm-hmm. leprosy because they thought...
Right.
You know, you would give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
But 95% of people are actually naturally immune to the disease.
Wow.
So I thought that was super
so much
interesting.
Fear.
Yeah, because I thought it was highly, highly contagious.
Right.
And in the book, they would have like, sometimes people would try to escape mm-hmm. the hospital
mm-hmm.
and the people driving by or coming by with a cart or whatever would not help you. And would call the police
because
they didn't want
contagious.
You in the community. Yeah, it was
yeah.
like scary. So the disease still exists in the world, but it's not very common in the U.S. now. And I read that it's actually not diagnosed in the USA very quickly because it's so rare.
Oh.
And often people will go years and to multiple doctors before being diagnosed.
Okay.
It's also the oldest known human disease.
Wow.
And it's caused by a bacterial infection. So in the book, Muriel and the other patients at the hospital suffered from severe stigma because all of these things were not understood.
Mm-hmm.
And Muriel's husband wanted to go to huge lengths to explain her disappearance and attribute it to anything but leprosy because he was... a silent film star, and he was becoming more famous.
Mm.
And there's a good part in the book, they would watch movies, and there's a good part about her seeing mm-hmm. her husband in a movie mm-hmm. and how she feels. She was just so horrified that she had this, and she thought 100% at first that the doctors were totally wrong, and she had just a ton of shame and humiliation because, you know, it wasn't like you knew people that were lepers.
No.
So that was really difficult for her. And I thought the book did a great job of showing how patients suffered emotionally from being diagnosed with this disease. They were actually kind of kept as prisoners at the hospital. And Muriel especially felt this. And in the book, they talked about how families of the different patients and some of the people that Muriel became friends with would completely abandon you and disown, like, your own children, their siblings, some of them were spouses or grandparents, anybody who had it, and would not want to receive your calls, would never come to visit. It was just, it sounds, like, terrible. People were just totally repulsed by the disease, and they had lots and lots of misconceptions about it. So you can actually visit the Carville Leprosarium, which I think would be a really cool place to visit. Because I guess I knew in our country about a leper colony in Hawaii, but I didn't know much about it. So
even the fact that they were in L.A.,
right.
She was sent off to Louisiana. See, you and I would have a great, if we just took a summer and picked all these odd places that no one else would want to go.
Right.
Like if you went to your family and said, hey,
like,
guys,
I'm
gonna
go to a leprosarium.
Are you guys excited to go to the leprosarium?
And probably nobody would be.
Except us.
So I looked up, the museum has a really cool website, and I'm just going to quote what it says. It says, the museum interprets the history, treatment, and rehabilitation of leprosy in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It honors those who lived at the National Leprosarium as patients. And it also celebrates healthcare professionals who made medical history as they battled leprosy.
Mm.
Because they did end up finally discovering this drug therapy treatment.
Yeah.
Totally ignorant of this part of history.
Yes.
And I was really fascinated by it. The author, Amanda Skenendorf, is a nurse.
Oh.
So she brings a medical expertise to the story, and her own background adds some good layers for the different scenes when Muriel is working in the hospital, helping the patients with different problems. You know, maybe they have like an infection or there would be different things that would afflict the patients, but also the people had like regular health problems too.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of, it was just a really good character driven novel. And
it just kind of gave some extra for you to go down the rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you could still go, like now I'm talking and still thinking of, I might want to go back to that. A couple of the articles I read. It's a really satisfying read. And Muriel was a very interesting main character, very flawed, and changed a lot over the course of the story. She had to become really resilient and dig really deep. And her changes were mostly to survive and move forward. And I was on the roller coaster with her all the way. The ending is going to surprise you. It really surprised me because I had an idea of what I thought was going to happen. And it's just, it's a great read. So
sounds like it.
That's The Second Life of Muriel West, which isn't that a great title
it? I was just going to say, that's, now that you've given me the description of the book, it really adds to that title.
Yeah, it's really good. And so it's by Amanda Skenendore. So check it out.
Okay. Do you know, and I hope you didn't say this already because I really was listening closely.
I could tell.
Is she real? Her, specifically, that
Muriel?
Okay.
No,
she was just wondering.
Character.
So the author's using that character to drive through the rest of the story.
Yes, exactly.
I love that.
It's
I love
really
her
good.
Story then. What a deep, what an interesting character to build.
Right?
Because, I mean, I really thought, wow, that's...
This is why I just, I love reading because after I, after I read this book, I thought, yeah, that is an amazing idea for a story.
Yes.
Think about a topic, leprosy.
Right.
And then you find out, I mean, I don't know what her process was, but you find out about this hospital where people were sent. And then imagine like a person that would never be there.
And then you build the whole story from that.
Yeah.
It's just really amazing.
It's so cool. Okay.
All right.
What do you have?
Well, I would love to share The Queen's Fortune by Allison Pataki. Always a good rabbit hole author.
Yep.
This came out in 2020. This book has been on my TBR since I read The Accidental Empress, which I loved as well. Did you read that?
No, but I remember you talking about it.
This is a bigger book, nearly 500 pages, but well worth the time and attention. So here's the starting point for The Queen's Fortune. Desiree Clary seeks to save her family from ruin or potentially the guillotine as the French Revolution runs rampant. She, at that time period, she was very well off. Her family was very influential. All of a sudden, Marie Antoinette is killed, and then people are anti-wealthy.
Right.
So it was back and forth between, is her family going to ruin? Is her family going to be killed?
Right.
Back and forth, back and forth. And the women really seem to be in the balance of that. Because, I mean, her brother, after her father passed away, her brother was in charge, and he would be the one that was taken away to be questioned.
Okay.
And they would sit and hope that he would come back.
Wow.
Those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So Desiree has a chance meeting with a young military prodigy named Napoleon Bonaparte. Her sister soon falls in love with and marries Napoleon's brother, Joseph.
Know he had a brother.
No, I didn't either. This whole thing, I think it took me forever because I just kept diving down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So at that point, their proximity, Napoleon and Desiree, and the and their kind of fire, they were both very fiery people, lead them into a very passionate courtship.
Okay.
Kind of secretive courtship. Because Napoleon has one goal. He wants to be in charge. He wants people to love him. Mm. And that is a constant theme through the book.
Okay.
So they then have eventually a secret engagement.
Mm.
They agree that they will meet in Paris once his career is settled. But Desiree soon finds out that he has taken on another love, Josephine.
Oh, boy.
And Desiree is a thing of the past and heartbroken. But for many reasons that you'll discover along the way, Napoleon keeps insisting on having Desiree continue to be in his inner circle.
Hmm.
She is, after all, his very first love, and he says that constantly. He looks up to, he wants to know what she thinks of his new fiance.
Oh.
Will you help? He forces her and her sister Julie to attend her for the wedding.
Oh my gosh.
So she's constantly in this inner circle around Napoleon. And eventually then his empress. And the political upheaval of the times in Paris. And within this time, Desiree eventually meets Jean-Baptiste Bernadotte. He is Napoleon's, like, really number one star general and confidant.
Okay.
With Napoleon's blessing, they marry.
Yeah, so, like, he's still in charge of who she gets to marry.
Yes, he along the way, before Jean-Baptiste, he had some other people picked out.
Oh, gosh. Like, he's her father or something? Okay.
Yeah, for her, kind of partially to keep her in the inner circle, even though she already was because she was very close to her sister, Julie.
Okay.
But also, so he keeps saying he wants to keep her in the up and up, in the upper crust of society.
Okay.
And doesn't think she can make that decision on her own. Eventually, Jean-Baptiste and Napoleon, though, find themselves at odds, both politically and personally. I mean, who would enjoy someone still wanting to have their first love near them?
Right, no.
Eventually, Desiree, okay, this is where it gets crazy, is swept to Sweden. Okay. I had no idea there was, during all this turmoil, that Sweden was involved. And she and Jean-Baptiste, who is renamed eventually because his name is too French, are eventually adopted into the, wait for it, monarchy.
Oh my gosh.
Of Sweden. Okay. This is all real.
Okay,
this
wow. Real.
For all of those years that she was sort of annoyed, if you will, that she should have been the empress beside Napoleon, until she realized she really wanted nothing to do with being the person people looked to.
Uh-huh. And now?
Now she's set to be the queen of Sweden.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So she is not prepared mentally, emotionally, physically for the role that she has to take.
Okay.
And she is not at all interested in leaving Paris because that's where her sister, that is her home, her homeland.
Oh, gosh.
And she's not happy about. She understands, but she's not happy about going to Sweden.
Okay.
First, what a tumultuous time. I knew it was a revolution. Power is passing between different groups of people for many years, but I had no idea how often and how violently these things were happening. I realized that this novel is part imagining, but these things were real, and the way every walk of life was affected was horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it was constant turmoil. You'd walk out of the house into the streets, and you would have no idea who's in charge.
Yeah, scary.
Or what was it wrong to be?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that day. Yes.
That day. Was it good to be wealthy? Did you need to wear a ribbon that had red, white, and blue? Or was it not good that day to wear that because power had changed?
Oh, wow.
It was a constant switch. Alison Pataki does it again. She takes a person almost lost to time, does amazing research, and brings her to life amidst a historic timeline that you can recognize. I know this book took me longer than normal to read, like I said, primarily because I kept stopping to look up pictures of the people and places that were being examined, and they were real. Mm. So Josephine, the new empress, of course, she and Napoleon started having some issues. And the place that she would retreat, like, you could look at it. You could look inside. I mean, everything was real. You could read up about her. It was just, it was really fun. It is more historical than fiction, and I love that about Pataki's writing. It reminds me a little of Signe Pike and the recent books we did a deep dive on, the Lost Queen series. When going down the rabbit hole, you can keep digging into research that follows the story, follows the timeline of real history. This would be a great book for someone trying to go from being a primarily fiction reader to a little bit of more of a memoir or nonfiction reader, I think. Because it has so much real history to it. My husband would kill me for saying that because he doesn't. He's a history teacher, so when I say historical fiction, he emphasizes the fiction.
Right.
But these books, Pataki's books, tend to lend themselves more to history than the fiction.
I love it.
And the growth that Desiree Clary makes from impatient, sometimes non-conforming teenager to being smart and savvy enough to continue to live and thrive in the political upheaval and circles that she was running in. There were so many times she and her husband could have been, we'll just say, eliminated from that circle permanently. But she finds herself placing her son eventually in a place where he can lead a nation.
Wow.
And that is so important to her, that she makes sure that Oscar, that's his name, is safe. I know you and I love to see a character grow in a novel. So this is a really fun one. So her books read so quickly, so don't be put off by their size. They're all worth it. And she has a new one coming out, Finding Margaret Fuller, which comes out in March. And I think we both have it on hold already from the library. So please check this book out. As such depth and breadth, and Pataki's books are well worth the time put into reading them. And that was The Queen's Fortune by Alison Pataki.
Okay, I am definitely going to get that one. That one is right up my alley.
Yes.
Awesome.
So what do you have next?
Okay, I have this great, great book that I loved so, so much. It's called Goodnight, Irene by Luis Alberto Urrea. Published in 2023. It's historical fiction, and the story begins in 1943, and it's unlike any World War II historical fiction I've read.
And you've read a lot.
I have, and I know some people say, you know, they're tired of reading about World War II. I'm not.
Right.
But if you are, this isn't like anything you've read. So it's inspired by the author's mother and her real life experiences. So here's the starting point. Irene flees an abusive fiance in her home in New York, enlists in the Red Cross, and is sent to Europe. Dorothy, mourning the loss of her brother at Pearl Harbor, joins as well, the Red Cross, and the two meet and become part of a group of women known as Donut Dollies. They run a truck known as a Clubmobile that's outfitted to fry donuts, brew coffee, and play records for soldiers in need of a bit of home. The women are sent to the front lines and must turn their donut truck into essentially an armored food truck. And then they follow the troops from D-Day to the liberation of Buchenwald. Irene is really our main character. Okay. She meets and falls in love with an airman nicknamed Handyman. And her dearest wish is that she, Handyman, and Dorothy will survive the war. I loved this story. The characters are really complex, and their experiences are really honest and real and raw. They're put into some absolutely horrible circumstances, and they always have each other's backs. And I thought this book truly showed the emotional and spiritual toll of war on these young people, because I think sometimes we forget that these people that were serving in World War II were very young. Some of them were still in their teens. So imagine thinking of teens or young people that you know today having to do this, basically saving the world, right?
Right. and not really understanding
right
why or how. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
The ending of this book is really special, and it was very unexpected. It's just, it's a terrific story all mm-hmm. around. And because I had never heard of the Donut Dollies, right. I was immediately ready to go down the rabbit hole. Now, I've heard of the American Red Cross, but right. I always think of them as blood donation places, mm-hmm. or in the case of World War II, being like a stationary place where soldiers yes. could go.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is kind of how these Donut Dollies started. They had places in England mm-hmm. where they wanted soldiers to be able to come and just blow off some steam or have a little taste of home. And they were getting kind of overrun, and they were mm-hmm. starting to realize that maybe soldiers that were in different places that couldn't get to yes. London also needed a place to go.
I remember us reading, I'll have to think about it. We read a book. We read a few. We read a book about someone helping at those places, some young women helping at those types of places, and the girls would go and they would serve food and things mm-hmm. like that. The more.
Yeah, and there was dancing. Yes. They
would
do dance. Okay,
yes.
We'll have to think about that
for you guys.
Okay, so here are some things I learned when I went down the rabbit hole. Well, first of all, the end pages of the book have pictures mm. of the author's mom.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And her friends. Oh my gosh, so good. So his mother, Phyllis, was in the Clubmobile Corps. And he says, quote, she and her truck mates were recognized as the foremost women in battle hmm. in World War II and were among the fewer than 250 elite Clubmobile women who accompanied the push through France, Belgium, and Germany after D-Day.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing and inspiring?
Yeah, no wonder he wrote this. I mean, you have to tell that story.
Right. Yeah. And his mother actually his mother is not Irene
okay.
in the book. She does appear as
okay.
Phyllis
That's
in the
fun.
Book. I just kept turning back yeah. to these end pages and thinking about just looking at these mm. women and thinking about their bravery and sacrifices. Just
yes.
so inspiring. So mm-hmm. he wrote this great scene in the book showing how these strong women showed up for one another. And it also really made me laugh
mm-hmm.
because, you know, they're surrounded by
yeah.
men
right.
all the time.
Yeah.
And some of the GIs that would come to the truck were just so nice.
Yeah.
And they would get letters from them
Aww.
Later and say, like, I don't know if you remember me, but I was at
yeah.
such and such a battle, and you talking to me for a few minutes
mm-hmm.
you know, really helped
cool.
me. Or
yeah.
they would get marriage proposals and say, you were the most beautiful woman and still are that I've ever seen. And if you're not married, would you marry me? So they really made
yeah,
a difference.
But
there were also a few that
yeah.
came that were jerks.
Right.
And there was one character in the book who was an especial jerk, and he would kind of show up at different mm. points. But so in the scene, that one of these jerk soldiers makes a rude comment about
yeah.
Irene, because they would, it was also a different time
mm-hmm.
where even some of the comments that they made, nice guys were making it about their bodies or whatever.
Right.
Like today we would like smack that down right.
right
off. But this was an actual really inappropriate and like mean thing to say.
Yeah.
And so about Irene, so Dorothy jumps out of the truck and starts to fight him,
oh my
physically
gosh.
Fight him. So this is what the author writes. Help her, Irene begs the men who are watching. Her, one responds, lady, she's kicking his ass. And it was just such a great, hilarious scene about like how these women
yeah.
like did what they needed to do.
Right.
And I loved it. So I also learned that the military leaders during the war realized that keeping this morale up was crucial to victory. Mm-hmm. So they put a lot of faith in the American Red Cross to do this work. I mean, that was what was placed on them.
Yeah.
You know, we need the men to have good spirits or we're not going to win. I mean, that's a lot of expectation. So in turn, the Red Cross put a lot of this pressure on these women. So they had such high standards for female volunteers that they were actually higher than what the military required.
Wow.
So here are some of the standards women had to meet.
Okay.
They had to be college graduates.
Wow.
So just think about this in comparison to what it took to join up to fight.
Right. Some of them lied. They weren't even old enough.
Right.
And the people would let them in.
Right. And they didn't graduate from college.
No.
So these women had to be college graduates. They had to be at least 25. They had to have reference letters. And they needed to be amazing references.
Wow.
They had to pass physical exams, they had to pass personal interviews, and it was so rigorous that only 1 in 6 were accepted.
Oh my gosh.
So if you think about these roughly 250 donut dollies, we are talking about like the cream of the crop of women.
Well, and I mean, for these women who had those qualifications to give up their life and feel strongly to doing this.
Right.
That put them at a different level already.
It sure did.
Yeah.
So once they were accepted, they went to Washington, D.C.
Oh.
And then they had to go through training to learn all about the Red Cross.
Okay.
They had to get immunized. They had to receive training on how to wear their uniforms.
Oh.
And that included 10 pages of information, such as not wearing earrings or excessive makeup or brilliant nail polish. So they had all of these standards that they had to live up to. And they, in the book, they did. Irene and Dorothy and these other women that come in and out really did. I thought it was interesting reading about the club mobiles themselves because they had gum, cigarettes, newspapers and magazines when they could get them, and a place in the truck, kind of at the back of the truck, to sit and talk. And there are some really good scenes in the book about the records and what they meant to people.
Yeah.
And it's so cool. So these club mobiles and the donut dollies were so popular with the troops. Now, you're not going to believe it when I say this, but in 1944 alone, just in that year, they served over 4.5 million donuts.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
And they didn't even have, it wasn't like there were a million trucks.
Yeah. Right.
Wow.
And so they had this mix that they, you know, it was provided for them that they mixed up.
Yeah.
And then they called the donuts sinkers.
Okay. Because they would drop.
I guess because they would sink down.
Yeah. They would drop in the oil.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so cool.
So
I love that they have this information.
I know.
That you can really quantify. You can already qualify, but quantify it.
It's so interesting. Mm-hmm. So they followed the troops through all, you know, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and then into Germany. It's just incredible. So they would be at the rear. So the army would move first and they would be at the rear, but they were caught in battle zones.
Yes.
It was just, and there was there are a few great scenes in the book where the women get to do some R&R.
Okay.
And that, I love that part.
I would think the men would probably be a little bit protective over.
Yeah, most
them
of them were. And in this book,
because they knew what it meant.
Right.
To them.
And in this book, the women, Dorothy and Irene, really went through some horrific things. Mm-hmm. That's why you're going to love the ending so much. Anyways, I Highly recommend this book. And I found it on a shelf of a book at the Granville Library that was just recommended by patrons. And I remember that a song, Irene Goodnight.
Mm-hmm.
Irene Goodnight, my grandma used to sing that. And I kind of picked it based on that. Plus, it had a nice looking cover. But so I thank the reader who put it there. I don't know who it was, but it's a terrific book, and you can really go down. You can read interviews with the author about his mom. You can read all about the Red Cross, the donut lollies. It's, I mean, had you ever even heard of that before?
Me neither. I hadn't. I think, again, another great thing about reading is there's just always something to discover.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing about this book. It's a little bit of a heavy read.
Okay.
So
it's good to know.
I mean, not that any book about war would ever be light, but it's a serious, you know, the characters aren't like light and happy, carefree gals.
They can't be.
So it's a little bit of a heavy read, but it's so, so worth it. I loved it, with capital L.
I think we're going to have to do another episode, a homework episode.
Yes.
And pick books for each other like we did
I do too.
Before.
Yeah, I like
because
that idea.
I really want
some
to read
some of these. Are just so good. Yeah. Okay, well, what do you have in your hand now?
Well, I got to listen to something very different.
Okay.
Nothing about it being real.
Okay.
Okay. I just want to, I got to listen. It's called The Curse of Penrith Hall, and it's by Jess Armstrong. And thanks to NetGalley, I got to listen to this book before it came out in December of 2023. And this is really the perfect time to listen to it. That's kind of why I saved it until now. This book takes place in southwest England in the Cornish countryside, and the setting is one of my favorite parts of this book. From start to finish, you'll be entranced by the setting. It's soon after the Great War has ended, and Ruby Vaughan, which I love her name, she's an American heiress.
Okay,
who kind of
perfect.
Yes, Ruby Vaughan. She unfortunately went through some tough times in America, and kind of her family sent her away.
Okay.
So she finds herself helping to run a bit of a peculiar bookstore with the elderly owner, who she becomes very good friends with.
Okay.
They live in a house together, kind of take care of each other, help support each other. One day, he asks her to deliver some rare and secret books to Penrith Hall, deep in the countryside, to the place her best friend actually lives with her very temperamental husband, Sir Edward Chenoweth. These names are fantastic. She knows she should just drop off the books and leave, Ruby does, but her friend talks her into staying the night, and this gothic mystery takes off from there. She's awoken that night by the bell that hasn't been rung for many years. Sir Edward is dead, and it is up to Ruby and the town peller, Ruan, to find out what has happened, if the curse has returned, and to see if they can separate myth and legend from reality.
What is a peller? The town peller?
Yes. It took me, I will be honest, if I were reading it in print, I think it would have helped me stabilize a little earlier, but a peller seems to be almost like a non-religious based, a non-traditional religious based leader.
Okay.
So you have in this town, you have the priest, but you also have the peller.
Okay.
And the peller is the one that handles kind of a little bit of mythical, has some different ways to treat illnesses, ways to treat things like curses, things like that. So he and the priests often butt heads about how to handle situations.
Okay.
But the real people that live in the village, the villagers, all depend on the peller.
Okay, yes, that makes sense.
Yes. So this was a really fun story. It got a little muddy in the middle, but the gothic nature of the setting and the manor were mesmerizing. I think this would be a great book to read under a blanket by the fire for one last winter read. Mm. And that was The Curse of Penrith Hall by Jess Armstrong.
That sounds good, too. Yeah. So we hope on this Valentine's Day you yes. get to do something you love.
Yes.
Like reading or like going reading. Down the rabbit hole.
Yes. Thanks for joining us. And please remember to rate and review us and share us, not with one friend, but today, since it's Valentine's Day, share us with two.
So glad you joined us today. If you'd like some other titles that go along with this theme, check out our show notes from today's episode.
Please share this episode with a friend and check us out on Instagram at The Book Bumble. We'd love it if you would subscribe to our podcast. Join us next time with a new bundle of wonderful reads.
Until next time.